Okay, let's start a lecture and welcome to the second lecture of the Research Methods course. My name is Mikko Rönkkö and I will be teaching the four lectures on quantitative research. And these will be taped, so if you want to follow what is going on in the lecture afterwards, I will send you or post you a link on the course forum after I get it from the editing. Also, I have prepared these materials mostly for postgraduate teaching, but I've prepared these as lecture videos in studio. So if you want to have more information on a particular topic, like, for example, what are the three conditions for causality, I have smaller clips that I've linked on the course website that you can follow. So if you don't want to watch the full video, but you just want to take a look at parts of it, then you can go there and watch a clip instead of this full lecture. And we had some questions on the course forum about the materials and the language. I have posted all the materials for my lectures there. So if I link an article for a lecture, it means that I'm going to be discussing that article or that book chapter during that lecture. And it may be a good idea to read it in advance. I'm sorry that I sent you the reminder today because I had marked this lecture for tomorrow on my calendar. So that's my mistake. I'm sorry about it. I will give you other readings later on after this lecture is over for the next lecture next Monday. Okay, let's get started on the topic. What is quantitative research? Any idea? So let's say that research is about, in social sciences, research is about finding out what's going on in the world, like what causes a disease, what makes people more likely to use information system than other people, what makes a system development projects more successful versus those that are less successful. So what makes research quantitative? What does quantitative mean, the term? You can also answer in Finnish, in which case I will translate your answer to English. So what does it mean that we do quantitative research? Amount of data is the important bit. I don't agree with you. The amount of data tends to correlate with the study being quantitative. But it's not the definition of being quantitative. You can have a qualitative data, a qualitative study with lots of data as well. The important part about quantitative research is that we are dealing with quantities, so we're dealing with numbers, instead of dealing with text or video or whatever other kinds of observations. Well, we have observations that are in numerical format. So we calculate what's the difference between means of two groups or correlation between two variables and things like that. So quantitative research is essentially research done with numbers. Sometimes you have a large amount of those numbers, sometimes you have a bit less of numbers, but the numerical data is the important part. Now, there is some, this kind of like an idea that people have that quantitative research is difficult and qualitative research is easy. And I like to compare that against this example of writing a book and doing a painting. So to write a book, you have to know how to write. So you have to understand some basics. But knowing how to write doesn't make you a best-selling author. On the other hand, qualitative research is like doing a painting. And if you can doodle something on a paper, someone could call it a painting, and it doesn't really require any skills to do something. But to be a good artist, it requires years of practice. So it's not that quantitative research is more difficult than qualitative, but you have to understand certain basic concepts before you can get started. And that can make it feel as if it was more difficult. The next four lectures will cover basics of quantitative research. This lecture is about research design and inference. So when we by inference, that's päättely in Finnish, we are looking at what kind of inferences we can make from data and how can we make sure that our inference is not due to chance only. So for example, if we divide a class into two from here on the left-hand side and right-hand side students. There are probably more girls on one side than another. So can we generalize that? Let's assume that there are more girls on the right-hand side. So can we generalize that girls always prefer to sit on the right-hand side? That's what we refer to as inference. Then the next lecture on next Monday, so this Thursday we don't have a lecture. Sorry, the dates are not updated for this year. It's about measurement. So measurement is about where do we get the numbers. So we want to do numerical study, but for example, how do we quantify whether an information system development project is successful versus not? So where do we get the numbers? And the third lecture is about regression analysis and its applications in information systems research. The regression analysis is a basic tool that nearly every technique builds on somehow. So understanding what regression analysis does will help you to read about 80% of quantitative research done in information systems. And it will also help you if you want to do a master's thesis using quantitative techniques. Then the fourth lecture will be, it'll be an example. So I'll walk you through a simple example of a quantitative research project. We'll start with the hypothesis, then we do some data collection, not for real, but I tell you how I did it, and then I'll demonstrate to you how I come to a conclusion using those numerical data. So it's basically takes all this together. Any questions about these four lectures generally? Good. Then we have some materials, and there, Singleton and Strait's book, the chapters 4 and 5 are required readings for the exam. Then we have chapters 15 and 16, and we'll be using parts of that on the lectures. Some of the exam content is based on also on those two. These slides are online, so you don't have to take photos unless you want to. Then chapter 15 and 16 are not required readings. We'll discuss some concepts presented in those chapters during the lectures, and I'll highlight you the parts that we'll cover. Then I'm going to be using an article by Venkatesh and colleagues in information systems research as an example. So we'll talk a bit about theory, and then we'll see how it's applied in an actual information systems research paper. Okay, statistical inference. So how do we make inferences based on numbers, and what kind of inferences can we make? Let's start with an example. If you want to read more about this example, it is from Mikko Ketokivi's book that I cite here, and I posted on the course forum as well, so you can check the ebook out. But let's go to the example. So in 2005, in the summer, there was a big news headline in Helsingin Sanomat that women-led companies were 4.7 percentage points more profitable than men-led companies among the largest 500 Finnish companies. So what can we say? That's a number. That's a difference between two groups. So men-led companies are 4.7 percentage points less profitable than women-led companies in the largest 500 companies in Finland. So what can we say based on this number? What kind of inferences can we make? I remember one headline being "Naiset tekevät tulosta." Women cause profits.
Can it just one number that you don't understand the background? What is it? So that is going to tell the truth. What it really means?
Yeah. So you have to understand the background, how the number was collected, and then there are also other things that you have to understand. People, when they see this kind of numbers, when you see differences, when you see trends, people want to attribute causality to the trend. So when we say that there is a difference between men and women-led companies, then intuitively we say that that must be because there's a woman leader in one company and a male leader in another company. But what can we really say about that number? We can say something. So it's not a completely meaningless number. So what can we say? We have an answer that we can't say much, which is true. We have an answer that we can't say anything, which is not true. So what can we say? We can say that in that year, in that sample of 500 companies, the women-led firms were more profitable than men-led companies. Is it interesting to say that in one point of time, in one sample, the women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies? Is it an interesting claim? Well, the question that we have to is an interesting fact. So that's a large difference. So the men-led companies are like 10% profitable, and women-led companies are like 15% profitable. That's a big difference. But it's just 1 year. So the thing that we have to, when we see a number, is does it generalize? So is it just that year the women-led companies happen to be more profitable, or is this something that always holds? Is it something that holds to only these largest 500 companies in Finland, or does it hold for every possible company in the Finland or all possible companies in the year, in the world, now and in the future and in the past? So where do we generalize? That's the important thing, because just based on one number, based on the fact that on the right-hand side there are more girls than on the left-hand side, we can't infer that girls always like to sit on the right-hand side more than the left-hand side. We can't infer that it's always in this class, and we can't generalize to other classes. So these two questions are the important things. So when we see a number calculated from what we call a sample, so a sample is some smaller set of companies. This is 1 year, 500 companies. We have to ask, what's the population? So to where do we want to generalize to? So what is the target that we want to make claims? Particularly saying now that companies among the 500 largest companies in Finland, women-led companies were more profitable than men-led companies 13 years ago. It's not an interesting claim. We have to understand what's the broader context, which context we make the generalization. And the idea of generalization is that we have to define what is the population. So population is like all the students in this university, all the companies in Finland, and then a sample would be students in this room, and 500 largest Finnish companies would be a sample of all the possible Finnish companies. So if we look at the fact from the previous slide, what would be a population of interest to which we could try to generalize?
A sample of companies within the
company. No. The sample is smaller. Population is always larger. So what larger? Where would we like to generalize? We have 1 year, 500 companies. So what's the most obvious generalization? Does it hold for other years? So we have 1 year, one observation. Does it hold for that decade? Does it hold for the past 50 years or so? So that would be our population, the larger, from which we take a sample. Or we could take 500 largest Finnish companies. Does it apply to all large Finnish companies, like the 1,000 or 2,000 largest? So we have to make that kind of decisions when we try to generalize. Otherwise, we really can't have any rigor in our generalizations. Okay, so let's say that we want to generalize this particular fact over the years. So we are just interested in the largest 500 Finnish companies, and we are interested in those and saying that is it generally true that women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies? The first question is, could this be by chance only? So is it plausible that the women-led companies happen to have really good years by chance only? Because the company's profitability, it's not same over time. So sometimes companies do well, sometimes they do poorly. And that's shown in profitability, and that's shown in stock markets as well. So could it be by chance only? That's the first question we need to ask. And what do we need to know to make an inference of chances and explanation? Let's say that we have 100 students here in the room, which is probably a bit overstatement. We have 15 girls on the right-hand side, 14 girls on the left-hand side. Is my claim that girls always want to sit on the right-hand side credible, given that data? Why not? 14 girls here, 15 girls here. So why is the claim that girls always want to sit on this side not credible? Yeah, if you have 19 girls, or 29, yeah. But if I say that we have 28 girls here, one girl here, would I claim that girls strongly prefer this side to be a credible claim? 28 versus 1. It's still one instance only. It's more credible than comparing 15 to 40. So we have to know, is it a large difference? If I throw a die and I get, let's say, 5 sixes in a row, then that's quite unlikely. So you would say that the die probably is loaded, biased. So we have to understand whether there's a large difference. In small samples, like if we have 29 girls in the room, then one side will always have more than other because you can't divide 29 into two equally sized groups. So we have to understand, is it a large difference? So if there's one percentage points difference, then we would say, who cares? That's a small difference, could be by chance only. So is 4.7 percentage points a large difference? Of course, you don't know, but what data would we need to make a call? Is it a large difference or not? If I say that there are 10 more girls on the right-hand side compared to the left-hand side, is it a large difference? Yeah, if it's 10 to 0 or 1,000 to 1,010, we need to know the range of the data. And particular here, the mean is the important statistic. So if the mean profitability is 10% and women-led companies are 5% more profitable than men-led companies, is it a big difference?
Yes.
Yeah, so a women-led company will give you 50% more money back than a men-led companies. So it's 10% versus 15 or 8% versus 13, depending on the, how many men and women companies there are. So and then we have another question also. So what do we need to know? Is it a big difference? That's one thing. Let's say that I pick randomly one person from the left-hand side and one person from the right-hand side. I compare their heights, and I discover that the person on the right-hand side is 10 centimeters taller than the person from the left-hand side. Can we make the claim that people on the right-hand side are, on average, 10 centimeters taller than people on the left-hand side? Why or why not? Somebody else. Yeah, sample size is too small. It could be that we just happen to get one tall person from the left and one short person from the right. If we take 15 people from the left and 15 people from the right, then our chances of getting 15 tall people versus 15 short people is very small, unless there is really a difference. So here we need to understand how many women there are. So we have 500 companies and 22 women-led companies. So we have 22 against 488 comparison. Is the number of women-led companies so small that they are the 5% difference could occur by chance only? This is where statistical analysis comes to play. So that is something that we can't really answer intuitively. But we have to ask the question, what would be the probability of obtaining this about 5% difference by chance only? If we have 500 companies, we take 488 companies and we compare against the remaining 22 companies. When we take 22 companies out of 488, we will never have the exact same average profitability for those two subsamples, because that just doesn't happen, except it could happen, but very rarely. So it's the same thing when we divide people by half. You're not going to be exactly the same gender distribution, not exactly the same height. But there are going to be some small variations. So let's take, I have this data. I have 500 companies. I take 22 companies and I compare with remaining 488 completely randomly. So we will get a difference of 2.43%. When we take a random sample of 22 out of the 500, take the mean profitability, and then compare with the remainder. When we do the same thing, we take another random sample of 22, we get a minus 1% difference. Then when we do it again, we get nearly no difference. So when we take a random sample of these companies, we compare the sample against the rest, the profitability of the sample will sometimes be larger, sometimes smaller. If we do this many, many times, we will get this kind of numbers. So that is about 50 replications, roughly. So we have taken 50 companies, 50 times a random sample compared against the rest, and we got that kind of differences. So this is called sampling distribution. So when we take samples from the population, our value will not be the exact population value, but somewhere around it. If we take 22 companies randomly out of 500, we compare with the rest, then on average the difference is going to be exactly zero because it's a random sample. So compared to these estimates, is the 4.7 percentage point difference large or not? Could it have occurred by chance only? So how many times do we get more than 4.7 by chance only in these numbers? How many numbers are more than 4.7? So, one, the more. You know, we got it once, and that's about 40 or 50 observations. So one out of 40 or 50, we will get a difference greater than 4.7. Now the question is that could the 4.7 have occurred by chance only? Based on this data, we say that it's reasonable that it could occur by chance, because we, from a purely chance process, we get that kind of differences. But it's not very likely to occur by chance only. We quantify this kind of analysis using the concept of a p-value in quantitative research. So here, when we analyze the same question a bit more rigorously, we will get that the probability of getting a 4.7% difference, if there is no difference whatsoever between men and women-led companies, is about 3.5%. And that's the p-value. We have a convention that if the p-value is less than 0.05, less than 5%, then we say that the difference or the effect is statistically significant. So we are okay in doing a false inference 1 out of 20 times. So it could be that when we have a p-value of 0.05, it could be that it's a false positive. If there really was no difference, we would make that kind of error once out of 20 times. So this all means that we have some evidence to claim that the women-led companies are actually more profitable systematically than men-led companies. It is, the difference is statistically significant. Oh, but it's by no means a certain inference. So we can't say that we are sure that women-led companies are more profitable. I would bet maybe 10 euros against 1 euro based on those data that the women-led companies are actually more profitable than men-led companies. So if they really are, you give me 10 euros. If they're not, I give you 100 euros. I wouldn't go any further than that based on this data. So we're really not sure about it. Then we have the important concept of null hypothesis in this analysis. So the null hypothesis is the counter hypothesis or the baseline hypothesis. The idea is that we have in a research, when we have this kind of number, 4.7% in points, we have a hypothesis that is evidence of systematic difference between men and women-led companies. Our null hypothesis is the counter case. So that's the case where there is no difference. And then we are comparing which one is more credible explanation. There is no difference between men and women and companies, and this 4.7% point difference is purely by chance only, and the alternative hypothesis is that, yes, there is a difference, and this is not only by chance only. Then we have the p-value 0.05 is statistically significant. So the formal definition of p-value is that it's the probability of observing the result that we just got, or more extreme, if there actually is nothing going on. These p-values are used all over. So if you look at any quantitative article, research article published in information systems, I will bet you, if you take a random article, I will bet you 1,000 euros to 1 euro that it contains at least one p-value. They're so common. Where you see this is in text. So in text you see a statistic reported. Here we have a claim written in yellow. Then we have supporting evidence, the numbers, written in green. And the beta here is some kind of statistical effect that you don't need to understand now. And then we always have the p-value. So when we say that the men-led companies are more profitable than women-led companies are 4.77% more profitable than men-led companies, that's our statistical evidence. And if it was a research paper instead of Helsingin Sanomat who wrote about this, we would also have the p-value for the mean. Could it be by chance only? So that's what a p-value basically answers. Another example where you see this is this kind of table. So we'll take a look at this table and what it means and how it's interpreted on the third lecture on quantitative research. But for now, it's important to understand that the table has these stars, and these stars here basically refer to the p-values. So what would be the probability of getting this kind of difference by chance only if there was no effect? So the p-value is very commonly used and basically just tells us that if it's a large number, so it's more than 0.05, then we probably don't need to pay much attention to the difference or the effect or whatever statistic it is. And then if it's less than 0.05, then we should get interested in the effect. So that's the convention. Let's take an example of null hypothesis significance testing. So I have this test of clairvoyance. I want to see how many of you can see the future. If you have taken this class before, this lecture before, you cannot participate because I've used the same example before. On the next slide, I will have two dice. Die is not by infinity, from 1 to 6. And you need to guess what the dice are, or if you can see to the future, then you will know what the dice are. So think of two numbers between 1 and 6. We got 2 and 5. How many of you got 2 and 5? Raise your hand so that I can... 2 people. Okay. That's pretty rare. So what's the null hypothesis here? You either knew in advance what these two dice are, or you guessed. So which one is the null hypothesis here? Null hypothesis is the more conservative claim that you're not clairvoyant. You can't see the future, you're just guessing. And you happen to get it correctly by chance only. So what's the p-value for guessing this correctly? So how many different observations, how many different combinations there are using two dice? 6 times 6 is 36. So it's 1 out of 36 to get this correctly by chance only. So if you get it correctly by chance only, the probability of getting that correctly is less than 3%. So we would say that you two are clairvoyant, statistically significantly, with p is less than 0.05. Do you feel clairvoyant? Yeah. If you did, you wouldn't be here. You would just go to the exam because you knew the questions in advance. So we're saying that if you answer this correctly, you're clairvoyant that p is less than 0.05. So this is a small p-value that we use to make inferences whether there is something going on in the population. We can make that inference incorrectly. And we have two different ways of being incorrect. One is the type 1 error, which we just committed for you too, that we are claiming that something exists, which in reality does not. So type 1 error would be claiming that men-led companies are less profitable than women-led companies based on a sample, whereas in reality there is no difference between those two sets of companies. Type 2 error is the kind of error where we say that no, there is no difference between men and women-led companies, where in reality there is. The reason why we make these errors is that we always have to work with a sample instead of the full population. So if we take the sample of students in this class and we use your height or your weight as an estimate of the full population of the university students, it could be that we just happen to have some tall and skinny people here, and then our inference would be incorrect. So based on the p-value here, we rejected the null hypothesis because the p-value for getting this correctly is less than 0.05. We have two options. Either you two are clairvoyant, or we just committed a type 1 error. Also, for the reminder of you who didn't get it correctly, we have the options that that you are actually not clairvoyant, or we could have committed a type 2 error where you actually are clairvoyant, but we didn't detect it using this test. Maybe you didn't want to be detected. Okay, so that's about p-value. It's making an inference of whether there is an effect in the population when we have observed an effect in the sample. So that's the role of a p-value. Now, let's say that we have established that This can't be by chance only. There's a systematic difference, and for some reason we know it. There's a systematic difference between men and women-led companies. So what's the next obvious question? Let's say that when we observe men-led companies and women-led companies over 50 years, the women-led companies are always more profitable. What's the intuitive explanation that people want to attribute to that kind of statistics? So we observe women-led companies are always more profitable than men-led companies on average. So what do we infer? What is the effect and what's the cause? Yeah, so we make a causal inference that it's actually the woman CEO that causes those companies that are led by women to be more profitable. So women cause companies to be more profitable, and then we have the policy implication that naming a woman as a CEO causes the profitability to increase. So when Nokia was having problems with their profitability, they were run by a man CEO, just fire the man and hire a woman instead, and the problem will be solved. What's the problem with that kind of inference? And is that kind of inference common? Yeah, it's very common. When we see a systematic difference or systematic trend, we typically want to say that one of these variables that vary systematically is the cause and another one is the effect. Here, the woman CEO is the cause and profitability is the effect. And this is very common that even if we are, this is from a consultant's report, even if you can't really claim based on the statistical evidence that there's causality, people nevertheless want to do so. And when this kind of difference between men and women-led companies, when they're reported as statistically significant, then companies, then magazines and newspapers go on and report that it's a causal effect, even if the original report says that it is actually not. So the next subject then is causal inference. So let's say that we are now sure that there's a difference between men and women at companies in the population based on a p-value or based on some other statistical evidence, and then we want to understand whether it's evidence of a causal relationship. But before we go into the causal relationship, let's discuss a bit of whether we actually always need a causal explanation or a causal effect. This comes to the purposes of statistical analysis. So the first purpose is description. So we just say that this is a sample. The women-led companies are more profitable than the men-led companies. We could also add statistical inference there and saying that, yes, this applies over all time, and this applies to all companies as well. Would that kind of fact be interesting? Yeah, why? It indicates that maybe there's something that we should care about. So if someone comes and tells me that there are, when the students take our exam, they fail 50% of the time when they take the first time, which is not far from the reality. That tells us something that that's something interesting. So description is interesting, but just telling us that students fail the exam half the time is not very actionable. It doesn't really allow us to do anything. It just tells us there's something going on, but we don't really know how to use the information. What if someone tells that if a company is led by a woman, then it will be more profitable? So that's a stronger claim. That allows us to do predictions. So why would that kind of knowledge be useful? No. If a woman, a company is led by a woman, and it'll be more profitable, it's not the same thing as naming woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable. That's not the same thing. We can say that if the sun sets tonight, it'll rise tomorrow morning. We can't say that because sun sets tonight, it causes it to rise tomorrow morning. No, that doesn't work that way. So this is a non-causal effect, but it's a predictive effect. So would that be useful? If a company is led by a woman, it'll be more profitable. What kind of decisions could we make based on that? Well, for example, if you want to invest money, then that would indicate that investing now to a women-led company would probably give us more money back than investing in a men-led company, if we were the only ones who know about this effect. So prediction could be useful. You know that in certain areas, houses that are red are going to be selling for less money than houses that are blue. That would mean that if you want to buy a house, then you don't have to offer as much money for a red house than for a blue house. It doesn't mean that if you paint your house that is now blue, red, it becomes more valuable. It just could be that older houses happen to be red, more recent houses happen to be blue, and that's the actual cause of the price difference. Then we have causal inference. Naming a woman as a CEO causes the company to be more profitable. Is that an interesting finding, and why would that be useful to know? This is the kind of knowledge that allows us to make claims like name a woman as a CEO and your company's performance will increase. So when we have a causal claim, it allows us to say that in a specific case, if you do something, then something else will likely happen. If you are sick, take this medicine and you will feel better. That kind of claims. Then we also have a causal explanation which goes beyond statistical analysis. So statistical analysis can give you the causal effect, but it cannot really answer why there is a difference. Typically, when research processes further, we want to build a theory or have some kind of explanation for why women-led companies are more profitable. What exactly it is in the women leaders that make them so much better than the men leaders. So that's the difference in causal explanation. Knowing that there's a causal effect is enough for many important implications. For example, we have some very commonly used medications used for anesthesia, putting people to sleep for surgery. We know that people will go to sleep when they get that medicine. We have no idea why it works. So sometimes knowing that there's a cause and effect, even if we don't understand why, is a very useful finding. So how do we make causal claims then? So let's say that you want to make a claim that this data here indicates that naming a woman as a CEO causes your company to be more profitable. What would a skeptic say? I claim that this 4.7% point difference is because women are better leaders and they will make the companies more profitable. So what would a skeptic say? You don't buy my claim, so what do you say?
There's other possibilities, like for example, that men tend to go for companies that don't perform as good as other companies.
Yeah, so if you are a skeptic, then saying that you are not right, that's not a credible claim. You have to present a counter-argument. So you have to say that, no, this is not an evidence for causal relationship. This is because men tend to go to companies that perform weakly, and then that's why there's a difference. The women has no causal effect. That's one way. Another way could be that say that women run smaller companies are more profitable, and it's not the CEO gender, but it's the company size. Or you could say that women tend to vary design industries, men tend to favor heavy industries, and then those heavy industries are less profitable than design companies, for example. So we have to think about these alternative explanations for the data. And to have an alternative explanation, we need to have some kind of theory. So theory is an explanation of how, what, when, and why something happens. So we need to consider, why is there a correlation? Could it be that it's just industry differences? Could it be that it's actually the opposite, so that profitability leads to certain kind of CEOs being chosen to run these companies? Could it be industry differences? Could it be something else? So we need to consider what is the skeptic's claim. So someone is not going to buy our claim, so how do we refute their counter-argument? We need to answer why are the ROIs different? And there are some alternate explanations. It could be that there is actually effect from the CEO gender, but it's the women are better leaders, they make better teams in the top management, that causes profitability differences. It could be that it's actually smaller companies or companies in certain industry prefer women, those companies happen to be less profitable or more profitable. Or it could be that, like you said, that the company's performance actually determines who is the CEO instead of the other way around. Or it could be that there is women, the gender per se is not the effect, but it's women tend to be more educated, more education leads to performance. So here we don't say that the women is actually, the gender is the cause, but instead a gender correlates with something that is actually the real cause of the performance differences. So we need to consider all these alternate explanations into account when we want to make causal claims using data. And we need to decide which alternate explanations will we rule out. And typically, when we rule out alternate explanations, we would need some more data as well. So here we have the profitabilities and CEO gender. We know the companies. We could easily take a look at how many people those companies employ. Could it be that it's a size effect instead of a gender effect? We know where which industries those companies operate in. Could it be an industry effect instead of a gender effect, and so on. So there are all kinds of additional data that we take in, and then we compare if the effect holds even after considering these different alternatives. So when we make claims about causal effects, we typically need to consider three different conditions. And this is this has been an exam question in nearly every exam in one form or another, because this is a very important thing. So normally, when we make a causal claim, we need three different conditions. So we need to know that there is an association. So there is a difference, or there is correlation, or some other kind of association. So men-led companies are less profitable than women-led companies is an association. Then we establish whether the association could have been occurred by chance only. We do that with the p-value. If the p-value is low, then we conclude that chance is an implausible explanation for the data. Okay, so we have an association. What next? Then we know that the cause must precede the effect. So we can't say that I fell sick today because I went out to rain without a raincoat tomorrow. Doesn't work that way. You have to have the cause before the effect. So I could say that I fell sick today because I went outside in the rain yesterday without the raincoat, and that's a plausible claim. So the cause is always before the effect. How do we take the direction of influence into account in the CEO gender example? So how do we know that it's actually the CEO gender that causes the profitability differences instead of the other way around? So I can't claim that I'm sick today because I went outside without a raincoat in the rain tomorrow. I can say that I'm sick today because yesterday I went out without a raincoat when it was raining. How do we apply the same logic to the CEO gender and profitability example. Well, we check who is the CEO, who was the CEO last year, we take the profitability this year. And then we can say that this year's profitability is actually the cause of the last year's CEO gender. We can't, it doesn't work that way. So the direction of inflows is typically established by measuring the cause before the effect. So people take medication now, we measure their health 2 weeks from now to see if the medication had any effect. We don't, they don't take medication now when we measure their health immediately, or we don't measure their health before taking the medication. It takes some time to take an effect. So that's, we have this time delay. So that's how we take the direction of influence question into account, almost without exceptions. Then for eliminating rival explanations. So let's say that we want to claim that women lead, women CEO causes company to be more profitable, and we have to eliminate these alternate explanations that no, it's a company size effect, no, it's an industry effect, or no, it's for some other reason. We have two strategies. One is experiment with random assignment, and another one is statistical control of alternate explanations. How experiment works is that we have a population of interest. Let's say that our population here would be only those 500 largest companies. Then we randomly, we take a sample, let's say we take them all, 500 companies, we randomly divide them into two groups. One group receives a random Finnish man as a CEO. Another 250 companies randomly chosen gets a random Finnish woman as a CEO. Then we wait 1 or 2 years and we check if the women-led companies are more profitable than the men-led companies. And the difference is a causal effect. So how does this strategy counter the explanation that this is due to industry effects? So we assign, one group receives treatment, and another one doesn't. Then we measure the characteristic profitability of these two groups, and then the difference is the causal effect. Let's say that we take randomly 250 of the largest Finnish companies, assign those a women CEO, then for the remainder 250, we assign the company as a male CEO. Then 2 years later, we observe that the women-led companies are 5% more profitable than the men-led companies. Why would the criticism that it's not a gender effect, but an industry effect or company size effect not matter? If we assign CEOs completely randomly, then there cannot be any systematic differences between the companies to start with. So they are roughly the same size, those men-led companies and women-led companies, if we assign them randomly. So experiments depend on this assumption that we have these companies randomly assigned in two groups. The randomization is the key. We do something for one group, something for another. Has any one of you ever heard about A-B testing? No one? So A-B testing is a system of testing information systems and user interfaces where one group of randomly chosen users gets one user interface called A, and another randomly chosen gets an user interface B. Then we compare which one of those two sets of users were more satisfied or more productive or whatever is our variable of interest. And then we get a causal estimate because the assignment is random. There can't be any systematic differences between the users that got the A user interface and those that got the B user interface. So that's the idea of strategy and then of experiment. And when we repeat this many, many times, then we can be sure that it's not a chance occurrence. So when we do medical testing, we have these two groups. One receives the treatment, another one receives a placebo that looks like the treatment for the subject, and then we compare the difference. We repeat it two or three times, and if our results are consistent between those experiments, then the medication is approved for sale. Importantly, for experiments, we want to show that the difference between the treatment and control groups is because one got the treatment and not because we assigned these two groups in a certain way. So is it feasible to study the effects of CO gender using experiments? No, we would have to buy all the companies for starters, because no company is going to volunteer for us to randomly assign them a new CEO. That would be quite irresponsible for the company who has responsibilities for their shareholders. So experiments is very strong design, but it can only be applied to limited settings. We can study people with experiments. Studying organizations, it gets more difficult. Then we have the second strategy, statistical controls. So the idea of statistical controlling is that we cannot experimentally manipulate the variable of interest, but we need to rule out the alternative explanations. So we kind of put all the explanations at once into a computer. So we have data about CEO gender, data about industries, data about company size, and then we tell the computer to figure out which one of these it actually is. How it works is as follows. So let's say that we have here, we have ROA for male-led companies 4.1. These are made-up numbers. And for female-led companies, 18.5. So there's a big difference. And we want to say that this is because the gender correlates with performance instead of for some other reason. So there are a couple of different strategies for dealing with this issue. And so let's say that we want to say that this is due to the gender and not because gender tends to correlate with company size negatively. It's much harder to become a CEO of a large corporation for women than for men. And also large companies are less profitable. So we want to say that this is actually the effect of gender instead of the caused by this third variable size, which would be a spurious factor here. So one way to check whether it's size effect or not is to make the samples more comparable. So the idea of a size effect is that the men-led companies are actually larger and then therefore less profitable. We can take that explanation into account by doing matching. So let's only compare small companies. Let's leave out the 20 largest companies if those are only men-led companies and see if the difference persists. So make the samples more comparable on the third variable. So let's say that we restrict ourselves with companies with less than 250 employees, and we get difference of 18.1 compared to 19.5. So if this is on the left-hand side is the all companies, and on the right-hand side it's the smaller companies, then we can conclude that larger companies are less profitable because the average profitability goes up when we take the large companies away. Also importantly, when we focus only on smaller companies, then we can see that the effect of women, of CEO gender is a lot less than it was originally. So we would conclude that if we actually make these samples more comparable by eliminating the large companies first, then we have less, our evidence for the CEO gender effect is actually a lot weaker. We can't say based on this analysis that there's no difference at all. We're just saying that yes, there could be a difference, but if we control for size, the difference is actually a lot smaller. So this strategy works really well when you have one variable that is a potentially confounding factor, like company size here. If you have multiple, so if you have to match these companies' samples based on industry, company size, company age, and whatever, then you quickly run out of data. So you can't make the samples comparable anymore because you just don't have enough observations in the data for all possible combinations. Another way is statistical modeling. And I'm going to talk more about this on the third lecture. But basically, the idea is that we tell computer that we assume that profitability measured with ROA here, return on assets, is the sum of geogender plus the sum of company size multiplied by some coefficients. And then we tell computer to find out whether the effect of geogender actually persists when we have the effect of company size there in the model. What that equation means more, that's a regression analysis equation. What that means, I'll explain a bit later. But the important part here is that at the research design stage, you have some kind of claim that you want to make. You have to consider what are the plausible alternative explanations for an association between your dependent variable that you want to explain, like the performance, and independent variable, what is the presumed cause, like the geogender. And then you need to collect data for those alternative explanations. Those data are called the control variables. This is a good, in the Venkatesh paper that I'll be using as an example, and I hope that you read for the next lecture and the one after that, explains this really well. So they have these plausible alternative explanations for a correlation that they want to claim is actually a causal effect, and then you control data for them. So here, if we take, let's say that we have a hypothesis that age of a person causes person to be less satisfied with the university information system. What kind of alternative explanations would we have? Students' age correlates negatively with the satisfaction on for example, corpus. So what kind of alternative explanations would we have for that kind of effect? So people who are 50 and study here are less satisfied or more satisfied with Korppi than people who are in their 20s. Can we say that a person's age causes satisfaction or dissatisfaction? So what do we? What kind of things do we need to control for?
How well they understand computers.
Yeah, it could be that the person in their 50s doesn't understand computers as well as the person in their 20s. And they are not satisfied, dissatisfied with Korppi, but they are dissatisfied with generally all computers. Could be. Could also be that the persons who are, people who are in their 20s have experience in high-quality information systems from their civilian life past, and then people in the 50, who are 50, have not used high-quality information systems before. That kind of thing. So you need to consider what are the plausible explanations. And then you control for those explanations by collecting data for them, and then you put them in the computer, and then you do magic that I'll explain on the third lecture, and then you will get, hopefully, a good causal estimate. So what's the difference between experiments and controls? In experiments, we have these subjects or cases that are randomly assigned on different levels of the interesting explanatory variable, and then we measure the outcome afterwards. If there is a difference after the treatment, then it must be because of the treatment, because of randomization. Then statistical controlling, we are not under the control. So we can't change people's ages or people's gender or who is the CEO of a particular company. Instead, we just observe things and then we rule out alternate explanations for the observed associations by using control variables. So this far we have discussed a scenario where we have an effect and we want to make a claim. So basically we have a theory that women cause profitability, then we need to consider alternative theories that we use as control variables, and then we do some magic with the computer. But can we build a theory based on a data, on a correlation? So let's say that we have a large difference. Men-led companies are 4.7 percentage points more profitable than the women-led companies are 4.7 percentage points more profitable than men-led companies. Can we build a theory based on that number that women cause companies to be more profitable? Well, at best, we can say that maybe there's something that we should be looking into. But we can't ultimately build a theory for two reasons. One is that there are all kinds of correlations in the world that don't make any sense whatsoever. Could be by chance only. Could be that there's a third variable that causes the correlation. Also, like let's say that my age is highly correlated with the world population. The correlation is probably 0.9 something. Does it mean that as I get older, that causes the world's population to increase? Or the increase in world's population causes me to get older? No, we can't do that. There's a funny example of different kinds of correlations. If you just look for correlation, you'll find correlations such as a strong correlation of 0.99 with U.S. spending on science, space, and technology, and suicides by hanging, strangulation, and suffocation. Does it that mean that U.S. should spend less money on science and space to prevent suicides? Of course not. There just happens to be two trends that are increasing at the same time. So just that you discover a correlation doesn't mean that there's a causal relationship. And also, the correlation, even if it was causal, doesn't tell you why there's a causal relationship. And to have a theory, we need to explain why something happens. Therefore, because we can't really go from correlation to a theory, we typically go the other way. So this is from Mikko Ketokivi's book, and he says that there are these different levels. So we have the level of a proposition, which is the theoretical statement. And then we have the level of hypothesis, which is something that we could actually test by using statistical means. And then we have the level of measurement, which is the actual measurement result. So the idea is that we cannot go inductively. So we can't say that that because women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies in 1 year, then therefore the women must cause the companies to be more profitable. We can go that way because it could be that the association is spurious, and in any case, an association, just a number, doesn't tell us why, what are the dynamics between CEO gender and company profitability. Instead, we go deductively, so we say that if women-led companies are more, women cause companies to be more profitable, then we should observe an association after controlling for other relevant factors. If we make a claim that women-led companies are more profitable than men-led companies, and we fail to observe any profitability differences between men and women-led companies, then our claim that there's a causal relationship is not very credible. So that's the idea. Then we reject the hypothesis. But there are, and this is an example of deductive reasoning from the Venkatesh paper. First, they explain their theory. They have a theory about information accuracy and whether more accurate information in government systems makes people more likely to use that system. So they have first a theory of why they think that information accuracy and then use of government e-services are related. Then they make a statement that if this theory is correct, then we should observe a positive statistical association between measured accuracy of an information system and measured person's use of e-government. So if the theory is correct, then the hypothesis should get support from the data. So that's the idea of deductive reasoning. You start with theory, then you present the hypothesis that should hold if the theory is correct, and then you collect some data, you put it to computer, computer does magic, and then you get the p-value, you conclude that if the p-value is small, then the hypothesis here would be supported, and then you celebrate because you just got evidence that supports your theory. So the idea is that theory is an explanation of how, what, why, and when happens, and then hypothesis is something that you should observe if the theory is correct, and we call this from general theory to a specific observation, we call that kind of reasoning deductive versus inductive, which is from a specific observation to a general theory. Questions and comments are this far about statistical inference and causal inference. Either it's all clear or I lost you all. Yes. Yes, that's what you do. And I'll talk more about that in the third lecture. Any others? Let's talk at the end of the lecture about quality of quantitative research. And what are the two characteristics of good research? In the end of a master's thesis, you need to address, among other things, you need to address two things about the quality of your research. Any ideas what those two things are? Reliability and validity. So reliability refers to whether you get the same result if the study is repeated over and over. So reliability is about whether your result is due to chance only, or whether it's a systematic result. So if we measure my weight on a scale, and the scale always shows 73 kilos, then it's quite reliable. If it shows 70, 75, 77, then it's unreliable, because it doesn't give us the same number when we repeat the same thing. So reliability is about this consistency or lack of random error. Validity, on the other hand, is whether our study is correct. So if I step on a scale that shows 73 all the time, could be that it's highly reliable, but it could be that the scale is off by 2 kilos. So if it's off by 2 kilos, then that's a validity problem. So validity is about whether the study answers the question that it's supposed to answer and does so correctly. Reliability is whether the study would produce the same result if we do it over and over. Quite commonly used the example is target practice. So if you always hit the same spot, then that's reliability. So this is a reliable, highly reliable. We always hit the same spot on the target. And then validity is whether we hit the bullseye on average. So this is high validity, but low reliability. Which one is a more serious problem, lack of reliability or lack of validity? So if you had to put your head in the middle of either of these two targets, which one would you choose? This is a high reliability, low validity. This is a low reliability, high validity. Which one would you choose? Who would choose this one? Yeah, and anyone, this one? You're suicidal. That is, the reliability problem is something that even if our study produces slightly random results, if we do the study many, many times, we do replications, then we'll be correct on average. So So in the long run, when we average those studies, we will be correct. If you have your head here in the middle of the target, and you stand here for a long enough time that this guy gets to shoot like 15 times, you'll die. If you have, on the other hand, if the sights are completely off, if you have an invalid study, then no matter how many times the study is repeated, it will not give us good information. So in quantitative research, we deal with reliability and validity using this kind of hierarchy first. So reliability is typically about measurement only. So it's about our data. And the reason why it's about our data is that we like to think that our data analysis procedures are completely deterministic. So if you give computer the same data, the computer will always give you the same results. So computers don't make mistakes. And therefore, if we get a different result from the same data, we infer that a different result from the same study, we infer that the data must have changed somehow. So reliability is about the quality of measurement. If you measure the CEO gender 5 times in a row, do you get the same result? We'll talk more about measurement next week. Then validity is whether the measures that we use are actually measuring the right thing. So when we study the effect of CEO gender on company profitability, we don't measure CEO gender by having all the CEOs go through medical exam. That would be impractical. Instead, we measure them by looking at their first names and whether the first name is a man's name or a woman's name. But that's not 100% valid, because sometimes it could be that one name is used for different genders in different cultures, or that the same name is used for both genders in the same culture. Then we have statistical conclusion validity. And statistical conclusion validity refers to basically whether the statistical inference part, calculating the p-value, has been done correctly. So have we actually identified the right relationships in the data and not committed type 1 error of claiming that there is a relationship when there actually is not, or type 2 error of failing to see an effect that actually exists. Then we have internal validity, which refers to the correctness of the causal inference. So let's say that we have established that there's a correlation or there's a difference between the two groups for sure, and does that correspond to an actual causal relationship? The internal validity in experiments refers to whether the experiment has been done correctly. Is randomization really random? In non-experimental studies where we can't manipulate things randomly, we basically check if all the relevant controls have been included. Then external validity basically refers to that if we have a study that is valid for a particular population, like if we study something about the students in this university, does it generalize to other populations, like other students in other universities? Or if we study the largest 500 Finnish companies, does it generalize to all other companies in Finland or 500 larger companies in, for example, Sweden or Germany or United States? So that's about generalizability. And this is something that you need to consider at the end of your master's thesis. And I recommend that if you want to do a quantitative study in your master's thesis, use this framework, because it's very simple and it's very widely used. There are also others. So statistical conclusion validity was about statistical inference, the p-value thing, and then causal inference is about either your experiments or your controls, have you chosen them correctly. Then how we actually do research is we start with the topic, then we have the research question, then we decide what do we measure, so what variables do we need, we particularly what are the important control variables. Then we have sampling, so if we want to study organizations, which organizations should we use? Do we take a random sample of Finnish companies? Do we focus only on the Jyväskylä area? Or do we perhaps go for an international sample? Then we do the actual data collection. And once you have your data, then the highest level that your study can reach is basically set. So if you have bad data, then no matter how sophisticated your analysis of the data is, it's going to be garbage in, garbage out. But on the other hand, if you have a very high quality data, then you can do an inappropriate analysis and then get an incorrect conclusion. But that's something that is fairly easy to fix. So when if you apply an incorrect statistical technique to a very good data set, then someone can easily tell you that, by the way, you should not look at the mean, look at the median instead. And then you calculate the median, you update your results. If, on the other hand, you have a problem that you did a survey study, and then someone says that, well, your relationship between user experience and user's gender is spurious because you don't include person's age as a control. If you haven't included the person's age in your survey form, that's pretty much impossible to fix unless you want to redo the full survey. So most of the time, the big mistakes in doing research are done before the data collection actually starts. Then a final thing is that is where do our data come from? So what kind of different strategies do we have for data collection? And this is one of those examples of a figure that I'd like to ask in an exam that is not included in the mandatory materials. This is from Singleton and Straits, and they say that there are basically four different ways where we get the numbers. So their focus is highly on the quantitative side of research, even though some of that applies to qualitative as well. And they say that, well, you have the laboratory experiment, which is one stereotype. You could also do experiments in the field, but the idea of an experiment is that you set up randomization, then you have different options or different treatments and controls, and you assign those randomly. If you want to study whether a certain user interface feature makes a system more easy to use than not having that feature, then you can invite 50 people to participate, 25 randomly chosen people, do a task using the system with the feature on, 25 do a task without the feature on, then you ask them whether they're satisfied or not with the system, and then you compare the difference. The difference is a causal effect. The problem with experiments is that if you do it in a lab, then it's not clear how well it generalizes to other environments, like real world. And also, what kind of questions are doable with experimental studies is more limited than others. Then we have the survey, which is basically asking people. So in laboratory experiment, one of your numbers, the independent variable, medication or user interface feature, is set by you. So it's set by a researcher. In a survey study, people provide us the answers. So we ask people to think about the last information system they used, and then we ask, were you satisfied or not? Was it speedy or not? And then you correlate those two things, and then you try to make a causal claim based on the correlation. The downside, the advantage of survey is that it's very inexpensive to do, particularly if you collect your data using online forms instead of, for example, telephone interviews or interviews face-to-face. And downsides and also upside is that you can study almost anything. So you can ask people about almost anything, and people will always give you some kind of answer. Then the downside is that the people who are being studied know that they are being studied. And for example, if you ask people whether they have ever broken the law, they may say that they have never broken the law, even if they actually have. So there is this possibility that the informants are not giving you accurate information. Then we have a field study, which in this book refers to a study where we don't ask people about the numbers or the information, but instead we observe people as they do something. So if you want to study the user friendliness of an information system, you could go and set up a camera in the computer lab and then record when students use information systems and then or whatever software they apply there. And then you could rate yourself how satisfied they looked and then what kind of features the software had. So the difference between field study and survey is that in survey people tell what they think, and then in field study you rate the people or your research assistant rates the people somehow. The downside with these field studies is that they are more difficult to set up, and usually the setups where you can apply them are quite unique. So if we have a computer lab here with video recording, it may be not legal to do in other places. I don't think it's legal here either. Then we have archival data. So that's the fourth stereotypical research design, and that is using numbers or data collected by somebody else for some other purpose. So our CEO gender effect was an archival data study. So Talouselämä magazine collects this data about who is the CEO and what is the profitability of each company. And then has been collected for their purposes. They want to write stories about it. We just applied that data collected for some other purpose. Some other examples of archival data are studying log files. So you could, for example, study, let's say, information security incidents, looking at logs that have been collected from some other purpose by somebody else. And the upside of archival data is that if you get data, then it's very easy to, you don't have to do much work to collect the data. The downside is that oftentimes data are not exactly like what you would like them to be, and you may not know how exactly those data were collected. You just have to trust that the data are good without having any control on the quality yourself. Yeah, then I have some examples, and if we have time, but we never have, so I'm going to skip the examples. Let's talk about next lecture, and then you get to ask questions. Next lecture, we'll talk about measurement, and I will be using the Venkatesh paper. I will post on the course forum which specific parts of the table of the paper I will refer to, and we'll be looking at some of the tables and how those are interpreted. Also, I would like you to read the measurement chapter from Singleton and Straits, because that's what we'll be discussing, and that's the only lecture that we discuss measurement. So if you have any questions about that chapter, then the next lecture is a good idea to ask those questions. Important parts from this lecture is that we use samples of observed data, and we typically want to make some claims about some unobserved things in the population. We need to remember three conditions for causality. So there's an association or a difference, and direction of effect. Then we need to rule out alternate explanations. The last part is the hard part, because you really need to think in non-experimental studies, why else could there be a correlation between CEO gender and company profitability, instead of it being a CEO, this gender effect. Then we have association must not be by chance only. That's the p-value. And then alternative causes. We had randomized experiments and statistical controls, and then we went through the five different reliability and validity terms and how they apply to quantitative research. We'll go talk a lot more about that in the next three lectures. Yeah, we can have some questions now, and if there are no questions, then I'll let you go. We are 1 minute past the end of the lecture.